Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
You know, and this is really, really controversial. We can survive without carbohydrate because we can create it ourselves. Now, it's not, it doesn't mean to say we've got to survive without it. You know, we can consume it and most of us can cope with it perfectly well. But for some people, they actually function better with less carbohydrate and more fat.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. My guest is the amazing Susan Wood, who is a UK registered dietitian and has been working for over 37 years in clinical practice, predominantly in the NHS and treating a wide range of pediatric and adult conditions. And today we're going to be talking about the ketogenic diet in all its various forms. In 2008, the referral of one young adult for the dietary management of drug-resistant epilepsy sparked Sue's interest in the ketogenic diet therapy. And since then, she's been pioneering the development of adult treatment protocols in the UK and raising awareness of the dietitians and adult neurologists to the potential that ketogenic dietary treatments can offer to adults. I first came across Sue's work when she lectured on my Masters of Nutritional Medicine program early this year in 2020, and I was just kind of blown away by the open-mindedness of Sue, how knowledgeable she was, how up-to-date she was in the research, and just how passionate she is about accepting that yes, there are some issues with the way the keto diet is portrayed in the media, but fundamentally, it really does have some significant benefits that warrant further research and further attention as well. I think you're going to find this podcast a real introduction into the power of keto diets, but a responsible podcast with the way in which we discuss it as well. I think initially I was treading around the subject with some trepidation, probably because of my lack of experience with it and my lack of understanding, but Sue's really put me on a trajectory to understand a lot more about what the benefits of keto are and the limitations too. In today's podcast, we talk about Sue and her background, the definition of what a keto diet is, the various forms, the uses beyond treatment refractory epilepsy, and you'll understand exactly what we mean by that terminology as well. We're talking a bit about brain oncology, so brain cancer and cancer tumors, what the wider applications of keto could be as well for multiple sclerosis, dementia, a bit about diabetes and glucose management, and also the mechanisms that are potential ways in which the keto diet works. Most people think it's just about the production of ketone bodies and the regulation of glucose in the blood that's kept very stable. But actually, there's a lot more research looking at how keto bodies and the actual diet can actually implement changes to the way your genes are expressed. So it has epigenetic effects, as well as changes to the microbiota, which we always love to talk about on the Doctor's Kitchen podcast as well. We talk a bit about the ways in which people can introduce ketosis. And I think just Sue's really a proponent of actually giving people the opportunity to explore these diets for themselves. We're all adults. We all have responsibility for our own health. And I think armed with the proper information is the best way to have these sorts of conversations. I really think you're going to find this interesting, even if you've never heard of keto before, or you've heard of it before and you weren't interested. I think this will give you some perspective on the clinical applications. If you want to find out a bit more about keto diets and you're a patient, I would highly recommend you check out matthewsfriends.org. It's a fantastic organization that Sue is part of. They do some fantastic work as well. It's similar to Charlie's Foundation, I believe, in the US. So matthewfriends.org, I'll check that out. And without further ado, I hope you enjoy the podcast. As I always say, one last thing. Give us a 5-star review if you enjoy the podcast, and do subscribe to the doctorskitchen.com. The newsletter gives you 2 weekly science-based recipes, and the recipe I make for Sue, I made her 2 keto recipes on today's podcast, will be found on YouTube. Go check it out. She really did enjoy it. Enjoy the podcast. Tell me a bit about how you got into dietetics, because you've been a dietitian for
a very long time, for about 37 years. So
37 years.
Yes.
So what is your secret? Wow.
So
I'm in shock.
Yeah. So that's it. So I studied at Surrey, you know, where you were doing your masters. Yeah. I studied at Surrey, and interestingly, when I was studying in my final year, there was a lot of interest in ketones, and that's back in 82.
Oh, wow.
So we're talking about a long time ago, because of course they've always been part of biochemistry and metabolism. You know, they're a natural component within us. So, but there was a lot more interest in it in terms of therapeutic aspects. Mm. But it seemed to sort of die a little bit. I think they sort of fell out of favor because at that time there was an upsurge in the interest in fiber. Definitely. But also, you know, fiber was gaining a lot of interest in terms of research terms. And also the fat heart hypothesis.
OK, yeah.
Was emerging. Mm. And in a way, probably those elements, because they were sort of more novel at that time, you know, they were really coming through in terms of driving research, and research was wanted in those areas. And I think probably ketones just sort of fell a bit by the wayside at that point.
Yeah.
And so I came back. I didn't think about ketones at all until 2008, when a patient was referred. I was working in a community hospital, and we had a referral from the neurologist that did clinics at the hospital for a ketogenic diet. And, you know, we didn't do ketogenic diets. You know, that wasn't part of our clinical practice. We knew it was done for children, but not for adults. This was an adult.
Yeah.
So after trying to refer the referral on and avoid dealing with it, finally it came back because, again, the referring on didn't work. They weren't going to have it. And so so I decided to take a look at it and see what I could do. And just on the basis that, well, you know, there was no going to be able to help them. So if I could just have a crack at it, it might be okay. Mm. And so I started investigating the possibilities for adults particularly. And really struggled to find other people involved, and finally met up with a colleague in London who was just trying to get started really and treat some patients. So there was a few people just starting at that time, really thinking about adults and trying to develop it for adults. And most of the information I managed to gather really came from abroad, maybe from dietitians in South Africa or in America.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I linked across the world really with other people who are interested, and adopted also elements from pediatrics. Mm. You know, that's all we had to go on, and just started like that. So it's been a very slow development really in terms of accessing or being accessible to adults, really, really slow. Yeah. But there is much more interest, and the interest has been developing over the world, you know, over the last 8-10 years for adults. Certainly, it's been accelerating.
Absolutely. I've seen definitely, I mean, one of the slides you put up was the acceleration of the number of publications looking at ketogenic diets as well.
Yeah.
So, but by the time you started looking at it for adults, had it been pretty established in the paediatric literature at that point?
Yes, absolutely. And services, I think what really made the difference was that in 2008, there was a randomized controlled trial published, and that was actually work that was carried out at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London.
Oh, right, okay.
And so that was the first RCT within the world of paediatric ketogenics.
Right, okay, I didn't realise that.
And endorsed its effectiveness as a means to manage drug-resistant epilepsy in children. So that was that really was a landmark study. It was brilliant. And that's made a lot of difference because, you know from the medical world that, you know, if you've got a really robust trial evidence, then you can actually it can endorse the funding for services. You know, you can actually then develop services based on that. Whereas if you don't have robust published evidence, if the trials haven't been done, it's not that it doesn't work, it's just that somebody hasn't done the trial in that way, then you really can't, you know, you can't justify things. You've got to have that level of evidence. So paediatric services have certainly expanded, you know, since that time, slowly, but latterly more rapidly.
I was going to say, it does seem slow, because it's something that I think a lot of, especially primary care physicians, would be pretty unaware of at this point.
Yeah, right? And I think that what you've also got to realise is that it is very much rooted within management of drug-resistant epilepsy.
Yes.
So, yeah. And that's what the trial endorsed. So it wasn't endorsing any other treatment of any other condition. Mm-hmm. It was the treatment of drug-resistant epilepsy in children. And so the services that we have really exist in all our children's hospitals up and down the country, and in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, Scotland, England. And so it is really just focused in those areas, and it really is a neurology focused, epilepsy focused treatment. So there hasn't been expansion to other areas, and there hasn't been crossover, a tremendous amount of crossover into the adult sector.
Yeah,
and so that's where it's really locked into a really quite a narrow area, and that's why it doesn't come out into primary care unless you've got a child who you've referred in. They're in tertiary care for their complex epilepsy.
Yeah.
They may end up on ketogenic therapy as part of their management program under their neurology team, their specialist neurology team. So it's quite specialised.
And do you think patient interest in this is really driving a greater awareness in the clinical community? Do you think it's patients essentially going to the doctor like, you know what, I've heard about this through the grapevine or through Google. I want to go on it.
Yeah, and I think probably it's turned a little bit within paediatrics, because whereas in the early days people might not have heard too much about it and it would have been introduced maybe by their neurologist, people often know about it now, certainly know about it within the epilepsy world. Yeah. And so it wouldn't be a surprise if it was recommended that maybe they would like to explore it. But it's not used as a first-line treatment. It's used when the individual has actually failed medication. So generally, the guidelines state that first-line drug, inappropriate dose. If you fail that, second-line drug, appropriate dose. And then after that, so really you need to have failed two medications, appropriately selected medications, at appropriate dosages before you would then be considered to be referred on for ketogenic diet therapy in a child. Now that's changing a little bit in certain specific epilepsy conditions. You might start it earlier. And we now treat more infants within the ketogenic world. You know, we're now realizing you can actually start it quite early on. Yeah. And certainly it would be a first line treatment for a condition called GLUT1 deficiency disorder. Because you really have got to find a way of ensuring that that brain has got fuel. And that condition obviously means that glucose can't get into the cells. Mm. So you really do need to supply that different fuel. And ketones are that fuel.
And is there ever a scenario or a healthcare system where it has become first line therapy for epilepsy, or is it always post
within the clinical ketogenic community, which is a very small community but connected worldwide? It's unusual for it to be first line. I would say that in the States occasionally it is, because they operate a different health system there, but it's still not, it's not necessarily it, and I don't necessarily think it, you know, as even as a dietitian who knows that it works, I think that it's not necessarily the right thing for everybody at all. And if one, maybe if you can try one medication, it works, and you don't get side effects from that medication, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. But if you are taking drug after drug or building up a number of drugs, you're getting side effects from those medications, then really those individuals ideally need to be offered the opportunity, if they wish, to explore this. And one of the fabulous things about it is that really it only takes about 3 months to know whether it's really going to work or not. So you don't have to be doing this for about a year or two and wonder whether it's going to evolve. It's a pretty rapid process. When you start switching the fueling in the brain, you sort of start to know whether it's going to have an impact or not. So yeah, it's really not too long. So yeah.
We should probably describe what the keto diet is, actually.
That might be an idea.
Yeah.
Right.
So, because we're wittering on about like the keto and actually its applicability, but I think for a lot of people, there is a bit of miscommunication about
what.
Because the number of times I've been approached by both colleagues and patients and said, I'm on a keto diet.
Yes.
And my initial, and I shouldn't really, but my initial thing is like, I really don't think you're on a keto diet, because that is a very strict diet.
Yes.
You have to you know, use different parameters and little testers to know whether you're actually in nutritional ketosis or not. So why don't we talk about what keto diet is?
So I would say that what I would do is probably define them as medical ketogenic diets, which are very, very precise.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would be what we would class as the treatment that we use within epilepsy. So, again, very meticulously modified, rigorous control over the macronutrients. So rigorous control over the carbohydrate. Generally, it is going to be lower than 50 grams of carbohydrate. And readily, it may be a lot less than that. So rigorous control of carbohydrate. Often there may also be control over protein as well. And of course, fat. So, you know, we often have total control over all those macronutrients. And so generally when we consume less than 50 grams of carbohydrate or so, roughly, then that will, in many of us, trigger a state of starting to create ketones. So a ketogenic diet actually is quite a loose term, because actually for you, you may start producing ketones even if you reduce your carbohydrate to 60 grams a day or 40 grams a day. Another person maybe may not start to produce ketones till they get down to sort of maybe 30 grams a day if they're trying to do it just with the diet. So it is a bit of a way, it's a loose term. So I think probably I'd rather differentiate it between, you might say, medical ketogenic diets, where you've just got really precise control over the macronutrients and you're trying to target symptoms. And so there is quite a range. And although I think probably what you're referring to when you were talking about the sort of meticulous manipulation was the classical ketogenic diet, which is really the approach that started in the 1920s. Mm. You know, that's, and we're still using that regime today.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about the history of the keto diet. Yeah, it actually goes back a lot more than people actually realize.
That's right. Yeah. So this treatment really evolved when it became known, and again, it's been known for a long time that fasting can often calm seizures. And so by fasting, we now know quite readily that, of course, that starts to create ketones. But fasting, so initially they found that fasting patients would stop seizures. So, but they realized that you can't just fast somebody forever. You know, you are going to get malnutrition and eventually die. So you have to find another way of replicating the chemistry that you're generating by fasting somebody. And that's how they started to evolve in the 1920s. They started to find ways of actually manipulating the macronutrient intake so that you could create ketones. Mm-hmm. And that's where this classical regime evolved, where you actually deliver the fuel, which is your protein, carbohydrate and fat, in this sense of a ratio. And so you actually look at And certain, some of the ratios were quite high ratios, so maybe 4 grams of fat to 1 gram of protein and carbohydrate combined. So you've got a very high fat intake. Perhaps even it's going to be 85 to 90% of your fuel or your calories is coming from fat, and the remaining is coming from your carbohydrate and your protein.
To give an image to the listeners of what that 4-to-1 ratio looks like, can you describe, because then what I'm cooking you right now probably won't won't fit the 4-to-1 criteria.
No.
What would that look like on a plate?
Now, well, it can look like lots of different things, and that's the intriguing aspect about this, because it is all about numbers, actually. And when we actually prescribe these regimes, we do give people very precise numbers to target, and then we give them ways of actually counting those elements. So choice lists and various ways that they can count them. So it's quite difficult for me to describe, because it will depend on... It's not just about that ratio, but it's the total amount of energy on that plate. So a 4-to-1 ratio meal will look different for a 2-year-old compared to a 20-year-old or a 25-year-old. And an important point also about this ratio business is the ratio is actually only just a mathematical tool. It's not a clinical, it's not a clinically defining treatment tool. So the ratio does not define the treatment. And when we're talking about very, very high ratios of very high amount of fat compared to protein and carbohydrate, you've actually got to still manage to provide adequate protein for that person's requirements. You know, all these regimes have got to be individualized. And what we know is that when we start to use these rigorous regimes for larger bodies, so adolescents and adults, we've got to make sure that we're still providing enough protein. So these very, very high ratios sometimes don't work, so we have to just bring the ratios down. But that's not a major problem. You know, really, for everybody just to understand, it's just really that we're actually encouraging the body just to utilize fat as its primary fuel. And by actually adjusting that fueling system in the body, you end up really delivering a cascade of changes across multiple biochemical pathways. And that's probably where it delivers its therapeutic effects. Yeah. So it's not just about glucose stabilization. It's not just about having ketones consistently present within the bloodstream. There are lots of other background changes that occur as well. It's a little bit like considering it a bit like seeing an iceberg. You know, the top line is we can see very evidently that we've got changes in the glucose profile. So we've got a nice, flat, steady glucose profile. We can see that we've got circulating ketones, and that's how we might monitor it and define it. But behind that, below the waterline of that iceberg, there is just masses of different things going on.
It's sort of similar to how I think we used to think about fruits and vegetables as just being chock full of antioxidants, but actually there's a whole bunch of other things going on when you look at metabolism pathways, how it interacts with your microbiota, how it changes redox signaling. And I'd love to get a little bit more into the potential mechanism of action for ketogenic diets in a bit. I'm going to bring you back down to this recipe
food.
For now. Yeah, back to the food.
I don't have a problem with that.
All I've done is I've just bunged everything in the pan, really.
Yes.
I haven't bothered sautéing the ginger, garlic or anything, because I kind of want it to infuse into that coconut milk. I've used a little bit of coconut oil. I've bunged in some sugar snaps, some red peppers, and I'm going to finish it off with a bit of cashew as well. How do you tend to eat? What are your go-to dishes?
So in my, my own personal diet, I do tend to, certainly over the years that I've been involved with ketogenics, I've certainly altered my pattern of eating.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not, I've tried going ketogenic because I needed to know how to go about it and also how to travel and eat as I'm traveling and things like that, because that's what our individuals have got to be able to do. They've got to be able to live with it.
Yeah, totally. It'll give you a really good perspective.
Yeah, that's right. But I do eat loads more fat. and I eat less starchy carbohydrate. Mm. But I don't get on well with wheat, so it suits me to make things like those keto rolls and various other things. It suits me to eat those anyway.
Rolls, yeah. Let me see this. Can we see those rolls? Yeah, yeah. So I completely forgot.
It's no, that's okay.
You're literally the second guest that's brought me some food.
Oh,
in the
wow!
These look amazing. Do you want to describe these?
Probably the most difficult thing to for people to accommodate is really this absence of starchy background foods.
Yeah.
And we use them as a vehicle, really. I mean, we use them as a vehicle to deliver the really tasty things, you know, the really nice things like cheeses or you know, interesting flavours. But it's really useful to have some sort of background vehicle, and also say for taking out with you if you're needing to travel with food. Mm. And so instead of using wheat flour, what we tend to use is we use ground nuts and seeds. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As the background. And you know, there are so many options now on the internet. We've got recipes on the Matthew's Friends website, but there's so many options out there for different ideas of how to make breads and replica breads. So no, they're really tasty. So they use whole, I've ground down whole almonds to make the flour.
Oh, and you then, made them yourself? You actually
Because I'd rather make them, I like the brown bit. I like the ground.
Whole, yeah, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
So instead of using it, it's cheaper also just to buy your own almonds and grind them. Mm. So, and then alongside that, I've put in some flax, a flax mix.
Yeah.
And some psyllium husk, which actually gives that sort of structure to the bread, because of course we haven't got gluten in there. Mm. And we use egg white as well, that provides a raising. And also some baking powder and a little bit of vinegar and some boiling water.
Awesome.
I mean, they're so easy to make. I mean, if I can make them, they are easy, really.
They look great. They look like, you know, the kind of rolls you'd get in a normal bakery or whatever. All right, this is your Thai style soup with loads of coconut milk.
Thank you.
Need a spoon.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoy that.
It's looking lovely and colourful. That's the one thing I do say. It needs to be colourful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And shiny too.
Yeah. It's got to have that good colour-shine ratio.
Oh, that flavour is amazing.
Yeah?
That flavour is absolutely amazing.
Good. I'm so glad you like it.
That's gorgeous.
Oh, I'm really glad. I'm a big fan of like Thai-style food as well and the flavour base.
It's not very hot. You've not made it hot.
No,
really warm.
It's got a little hint of heat at the end because instead of finely chopping the chilli and then whacking that in, I've literally just sliced it in half, taken the seeds out, and then put it in so you get a hint of warmth at the back.
Yeah.
And I've used for the first time a vegetarian fish sauce, which I never knew existed.
Gosh.
So you've got seaweed-based the saltiness from the seaweed, which is really like quite pungent and the concentrated.
Yes.
So that for me was a new find. So I loved doing this experiment. Cool. How was your lunch?
The lunch was lovely, thank you. Really good. And how did you enjoy your rolls?
The keto rolls are great. It's a new thing. I didn't know that was a thing. So I'm pleasantly surprised. And those crackers I'll definitely make.
Yeah, they're really easy to do. Really
yeah,
easy.
I'm going to have to put the recipe for that actually in the show notes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. So we've talked a lot already in the break as well.
Yeah.
About a bit about yourself, how you got into this, you know, how long you've been in the clinical dietetics, the history of ketogenesis as well, in terms of the fact that it was there from the 1920s.
Yeah, it's a long time.
The uses beyond epilepsy, I think, are quite interesting. Have we covered pretty not everything to do with epilepsy, but
difficult to say. I think what I would just say about epilepsy is that it's not a case of ketogenic diet or anticonvulsant medications. Mm. It's very much knitted in with the whole lot. So, and most individuals who even get a good response from ketogenic diet remain on maybe one or, you know, a couple of anticonvulsant medications as well. So it's not separated.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's part of the whole neurological care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really important to see it as that. It's part of the, it's almost like an anticonvulsant, but it's in food form.
Yeah.
So it's carefully monitored.
Absolutely, yeah. And how easy is it, in your experience, for people to be referred now, given that, you know, it's 10 years after we had those results from Gosh, to be referred into clinical dietitians with expertise?
I think there are the neuro keto teams in the paediatric centres. And yes, children are referred in. And so there has been expansion of availability of treatment in recent years for children. And I think that what's happened is there has been a slight expansion within the adult sector, but not sufficient. And I think there are a number of adults who would like to explore it, but they just can't get treatment. They might not be classed as having such difficult epilepsy, or there just aren't the services around them to be able to offer the treatment. But they really do need help with the navigation.
Yeah.
You know, it's not great just trying that out by yourself. You could do with having the help and navigation. But having said that, we have encountered people being referred to us who have had to start on their own, you know, and then they've ended up finally getting referred. And I think it's just that it's quite tough really doing it on your own, and you may not navigate it ideally. You may not get the results you're looking for. And so it's really helpful to have support from experts that know how to navigate.
Yeah.
And so they can get you to the place you want to go, or they can actually say, look, we've done what we can, and the effect, we can't seem to get maybe the optimal effect. Because it's about 50% of individuals with drug resistant epilepsy will get a 50% reduction in seizures. And if they have often, by the time they've reached that, ketogenic therapy, they've failed many, many, many drugs. So the chance of another drug coming along and actually having that effect, well, there just aren't drugs around that would do that. So it's remarkable for those individuals who are drug resistant, it can still have a very significant effect. But still, it doesn't always work. And very, very occasionally, this is really occasionally, we get people who it makes them worse. So, you know, that's why it's just important to have some guidance to navigate.
I definitely want to get onto the potential adverse effects of the diet as well, and the impact on quality of life. But what I'm really interested in is the wider application of the ketogenic diet, which we've established of different forms and different ratios. And how or why that might be having an effect. So the mechanism of action that we've briefly touched on, I'm assuming it goes beyond just the production of ketone bodies via your liver and the stabilization of glucose in your serum.
It's really quite difficult, even though it's been around for about 100 years now. The mechanisms of action, you know, it's very hard to pinpoint in each individual. And there are many mechanisms of action. So we do know, as you said, about that stabilization of glucose and the provision of ketones as an alternative fueling for the brain tissue. That probably alters, that stabilizes the system, the neurotransmission, and actually really just ramps up the wall against seizures coming through. But also its antioxidant status, inflammatory pathways are influenced, the gut microbiota are altered. And so there's just so many different aspects, also epigenetic impact. So, you know, it's the way that genes are expressed. And so really for each individual, it may well be that it's one thing or another thing that's the predominant reason why it's working, maybe for them. But I think it's also important to see it as not being something very specific. It's really, it's a really base level change in the system, because every single cell in our body has to have fuel. You know, we are just built of, you know, billions of tiny cells. Every cell has got to be fueled, and if your fueling's not working properly, or if your mitochondria just aren't functioning properly, then, you know, it is possible that maybe this shift in fueling of the systems may actually enable things to work better. And I think this is this, it's this really base level, almost like just adjustment in the fueling availability, that is has captured the interest in sort of broad neurological applications.
Yeah, which is why it's quite interesting to see the potential applications of keto to things like, well, brain tumours that we'll get onto in a little bit, but multiple sclerosis and a whole bunch of other fields as well, chronic pain, migraine. Is there some sort of common feature in that you've got hyper-functioning of the cell's ability to utilize glucose. Is that something that we're seeing in different...
I think that's it. Probably is that sort of... When a section of the brain or when the tissue is struggling or if it's not appropriately fueled, then it just can't work properly. So therefore, you know, this possibly this hypometabolic state may underpin quite a lot of these. It may be a common link between some of these conditions.
Yeah.
And so just by altering and providing that alternative fuel and also the shifts in various pathways just enables functionality to be improved.
Yeah.
Those individuals with epilepsy who do get benefits through the seizure control, but they also talk about other aspects such as just feeling a bit clearer, having more energy, and just being able to, you know, just being able to have a chat with somebody or be able to play with your kids and have energy. It's all these different things. And actually, it's not so much maybe about the seizures, it's about the life between seizures.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point you make, because too often I see in clinical medicine that we judge the efficacy of drugs purely on, say, in the case of epilepsy, reducing the seizure threshold, or increasing the seizure threshold. Where in reality, we want to be looking at the holistic picture of the patient.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
There's no point removing seizures if it's at the expense of them being able to do normal cognitive tasks or have the energy to go outdoors. And it seems, at least from some of the papers that we've seen looking at small numbers, that people's fatigue energy levels have improved whilst being on the keto diet, obviously mitigating against the other potential adverse effects as well.
No, and I think it's really tough, you know, within neurology when you know a neurologist is dealing with patients with epilepsy, and you have got to try and stop those significant seizures. You know, their seizures are dangerous, particularly tonic-clonic seizures. You know, and you do have to try and control them. But it is always a really tricky balance. And it's very, very tough. It's not an easy job, you know, because because you have got to try and titrate things. But if somebody's carrying on having seizures, what do you do? So, you know, I don't think that's an easy task. but this is where I just think that, well, ketogenics can just bring an element, the ketogenic diet therapy can bring another element into the mix. And it can then even modify those elements that we perceive are being, or maybe the side effects of a medication. You can bring in the ketogenic therapy and all of a sudden things might just settle right down. So you've still got your five anticonvulsant medications in place. You might bring in ketogenic therapy, things settle down. You've then got the opportunity, or within the neurology team, you've got the opportunity to think, right, okay, do we need all these medications now? Could we just peel them off very slowly, very, very slowly? And just reduce the doses so that you are just enabling just a little bit less medication and hopefully improving the quality of life of that individual.
Absolutely.
I think the other thing, important thing to say is that we've got many adults that we treat who are, they're very much like children. You know, they've got very complex needs, very complex disorders, multiple issues. And so, you know, they are more like children. But, you know, there are also adults who are quite capable of delivering the treatment for themselves. And if they're appropriately supported, it's absolutely fabulous because they know what they're doing is they can feel it.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting when a young person can feel what they're doing and they can really know they've got that power in their hands.
It's a hugely motivating factor, isn't it, that you've got something within the locus of your control that you do outside of hospital appointments with your neurologist or clinician that's actually having a positive impact on your condition. And it still amazes me that beyond that, the diet has this incredible ability to impact a whole bunch of different pathways. So we touched briefly on the mechanism of action of the potential mechanisms of action of keto having pleiotropic effects. One thing I think it always comes back down to the gut microbiota as well. I read this paper, I think it was in Nature a couple of years ago, about how the ketogenic diet might be potentiated by the changing, the shift of microbes and how that creates different metabolites that can have the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier and reduce excitatory potentials of neurons as well.
No, it's fascinating. And I think this is a new I mean, the microbiota component is really coming into all aspects of medicine. Mm. And certainly it's now being well accepted that the gut and brain, I mean, they've always been attached and connected, but, you know, they're maybe even more connected than we thought. Mm-hmm. That diet, and therefore, you know, we know that ketogenic diet influences the gut microbiota and affects the brain. But that means really probably all dietary changes and all diets influence the microbiota mm-hmm. and can affect the brain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have got to think more widely than just even ketogenics.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
But we do know that ketogenics may mediate, in some individuals, it may well be mediating its effect via the gut microbiota.
Yeah. And we've got all these papers looking at potential mechanisms. You mentioned epigenetics as well, so yeah. The ability of... I think is an inhibitor of histone deacetylases.
That's right, yes.
So it can actually have an impact on the way your genes are expressed, essentially the field of epigenetics. Mm. But how easy is it to separate, I suppose this comes on to a later question I have as well, how easy is it to separate the beneficial impact of ketogenic diets from just looking at maintenance of good glucose levels around 4 to 5 millimoles per litre?
Yeah, I think that's really difficult.
Yeah.
what I would probably say is that it is quite difficult to achieve the almost like the rock steadiness you get from a really low carbohydrate intake, mm-hmm. because it's about the effect that it has on the insulin levels. You know, it's about other things behind just the glucose. Mm. And what we are aware, and this is where, you know, when you're learning and seeing what's happening to patients, you suddenly think, hang on a minute, you know, the glucose of these kids, it's always like 4.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really shift. Gosh, that might be really handy within diabetes.
Yeah.
I think this is the thing. There's more to it than that. There is more to it than that. But that's a very it's a very intriguing, a very interesting top line, very, very easy to spot and track aspect of it. Mm. And I would say for some people, maybe it is just that stabilization of the glucose, and maybe that can be achieved in a more moderate carbohydrate control. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just as I think I was talking to you over lunch, we would always try and use the lowest dose of treatment that we can manage. So we would go in, when we start introducing this treatment, we would go in with a low level of ketone producing diet, mm-hmm. so a lower ratio diet, and we would step it in gradually. So we want to try and achieve the maximum effect with the minimum dose.
Yeah.
So that we can actually enable them to have a broader access to carbohydrate sources, that sort of thing.
I definitely appreciate, I think at the macro level you have this like stabilized glucose, but there are all these other things going on behind the curtain,
so to speak. Absolutely, that's super interesting.
Do you find like there's differences between using different chain lengths of fats in the diet? So you've got the long chain fats, for example, and the shorter saturated fats as well. Does that have an impact on the ability to achieve ketosis and maintain it?
I mean, that's a really interesting and really glad you brought that up, actually. We've got our dietary fats are made up of lots of different chain lengths. And there is a group of fats called the medium chain triglycerides, which have got a carbon chain length of between 6 to 12 carbons. And they actually are digested and absorbed in a slightly different way. So therefore, they can actually be transported very rapidly, absorbed very rapidly, directly, and can be processed in the liver, and ketones can be generated from them. And so MCT fats can be useful. The way that we do use them within clinical ketogenic therapy, and we can either use them as a dominant component of an MCT ketogenic diet, so up to maybe even 60% of the calories from the diet comes from MCT fats.
Oh, right.
So really quite high.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you actually deliver it in that way, you can actually incorporate more carbohydrate and a little bit more protein.
Right.
So it's a very specified diet. But because you've got the presence of more MCT fats, which are more pro-ketogenic, it enables you to include a little bit more of them, what you might consider the anti-ketogenic components in the diet. So you can just allow a bit more carbohydrate.
Interesting.
But the MCT has to go in alongside everything.
Okay, so it has to be consumed as part of
it. It has to be consumed as a part of every meal or snack. So it's not a case of, well, you know, just whack it in at the beginning of the day and just eat what you like. No, it's not like that at all. It actually has to be. So you are balancing up each meal, really, with an element of MCT and certain amounts of protein, carbohydrate and long-chain fats. But I think what's happened in the time that I've been involved with the ketogenics, which is really relatively recently, just about sort of, you know, 8 to 10 years, we are really going towards a much more of a sort of a portfolio. We borrow from all these different practices and we just try and create something that works for that individual. So we might try using what we would call a modified ketogenic diet. So that would just start by really controlling the carbohydrate and adding in enough fat for satiety and enough fat to give enough fuel. But we wouldn't necessarily control the protein excessively. We'd just say moderate amounts. And we may then, as we see what we get from just the initial starting point, see how things evolve, see what we're getting in terms of symptom control. But we may just say, right, well, let's just add a little bit of MCT into your meals and see if this just amplifies the effect a little bit more. So we would actually use it as a fine-tuning tool in lots of different ketogenic regimes.
Yeah, oh, that's brilliant. Because I've heard through the grapevine that people are kind of cheating on keto by just swigging a whole bunch of MCT oils in combination with the meals. Is it actually possible to achieve ketosis with a...
It is. I think where... and again, it depends on what you're trying to use that nutritional ketosis for.
Exactly, yeah.
So for your eye... who don't have problems with seizures, you know, it really doesn't matter to us whether our glucose wanders a little bit or we have ketones for one moment and they happen to have gone by the end of the day. Mm-hmm. That won't necessarily affect us. Mm-hmm. But for somebody who has epilepsy, then actually you've got to get some element of sort of stabilization of that fueling.
Yeah.
So using MCT intermittently and not using it consistently in consistent amounts might lead to being more unstable.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can, if for example, an individual sort of just dropped their carbohydrate intake down and started taking large amounts of MCTs, then that would amplify their potential to become ketotic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I think they do need to be used cleverly.
Yeah.
But they can be very helpful, but they need to be used as a component of the mix.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, yeah. Because from my basic biochemistry understanding, you have your long chains and those are taken up by chylomicrons and they're processed in the liver and then they get, you know, either converted into...
So that's a slower process. Mm. So the way that I would describe MCTs, they're a bit more like the glucose of the fat world.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, we've got glucose and starches and fibrous starches and things. So the glucose... it's a little bit more sophisticated than that though, but the glucose, we say, goes in really, really fast. Okay, so MCTs are a bit like that, go in and quite fast. So what you also do need to have is some other long chain fats underpinning as well, because if you just had all MCT, it'd be like, you know, you'd be a bit sort of up and down. So you do need to have it underpinned with other elements. But it's useful, very useful, and it can be very, very useful to fine-tune the approach.
I was going to say, actually, because it seems that the fluctuation in your ketone bodies, of which from memory there are three main ones, the beta hydroxybutyrate, acetoacetate,
acetone, which you breathe, that's volatile, you actually breathe that out.
So actually, if you're required to be on this nutritional ketosis diet, we'll go into the difference between nutritional ketosis and ketoacidosis in a sec, but if you're having fluctuations based on the amount of MCT and the amount of fat you put in your diet, then that's not going to be great for medical keto.
No, and again, I think it would depend on what you're trying to control.
Yes, yeah.
But what I would say is that's probably not ideal for most people who are using it to control seizure activity, because I think for seizure activity we do seem to have to make it quite, you know, quite precise. For some people maybe not so much, but for many it does have to be a bit more precise. Whereas if somebody was using it for some other reason, some people with type 2 diabetes may use a ketogenic or a lower carbohydrate, higher fat, almost towards ketogenic diet, maybe that wouldn't make a lot of difference to them. It's difficult to say.
Yeah.
But I think if you're controlling things, the control, you know, within the electrical activity within the brain, I think you've got to be, really quite consistent.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you notice, or I don't know if this is introduced into the regimes now, but whether starvation or fasting or intermittent fasting has helped maintain or at least achieve nutritional ketosis in the short term? Or is that something that you don't really go into? I suppose it depends on the client as well, because you're dealing with kids, you're not going to be able to.
No, that's right. But actually, and again, it's a good point you brought up, because traditionally, these regimes used to be introduced after a fast. Mm. Because by fasting, your body is saying, oh, hey, you know, there's no carbohydrate coming in here, no fuel coming in here. I need to start moving over to actually utilizing some fats. So your body's already priming itself. It's already starting to move. And then what you do is then you present the body with, you know, a higher amount of fat, very little carbohydrates. So it persists in that movement, and it becomes adapted to that process. But by fasting, you're pushing the adaption really quite fast, quite quickly, not to confuse the fasting.
Yeah.
your movings are rather quickly. And so you are going to be, so children who are fasted and then put onto a ketogenic diet may have more instances of maybe vomiting, hyperketosis, low blood glucose levels, because you're really making things adapt very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And so this is where, because most of these treatments are initiated, the training might go on in the hospital setting, but they're initiated at home. So, you know, and they are walked in over a matter of, maybe walked in over a matter of days or weeks. Mm-hmm. So you're actually just enabling the body just to adjust itself much more steadily. So you're going to minimize the issues associated with really forcing a quick adaption.
Quick adaption.
And so you're going to get away from things like, you know, vomiting, again, hypoglycemia. We don't want the children to end up like that.
Yeah,
so that's why it's better to actually introduce things steadily and monitor. Mm. You know, we train the families so that they know what to look for. They know what to look for, and they know how to cope with it. So we always train them how to, if they're seeing that the glucose levels are dropping and the ketones are going up, they know that they give some carbohydrate.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the same way as you would manage a situation within a diabetic.
Exactly, yeah, with hypers and having some.
But, you know, if you're walking slowly, you're going to not necessarily get that.
Yeah.
And so unless we really want a quick effect, you've got somebody really seriously ill, we need a very quick effect, they might be hospitalized, you actually want to get the ketone levels up fast, you might just go through with it. But generally we try and walk it in, so you're minimizing those effects, those potential adverse effects of adaption.
I think generally we need to start talking about ketones in a more positive fashion, because the first time I heard about nutritional ketosis, I thought immediately ketoacidosis, very different, very bad, something that we see with type 1 diabetics.
Yes.
But actually ketones are a very normal part of our physiology,
something
our liver does naturally. Like first thing when you wake up, you might actually be producing a
That's
few ketones
right.
more likely as you fasted technically overnight. But yeah, maybe we should probably distinguish between nutritional ketosis.
That's right. So they're a normal part of our, they're a normal part of our biochemistry. And for most of us, there is a small number of individuals who really struggle to utilize fats and make ketones and produce this supplementary fuel. But for the majority of us, we are highly adaptable, multi-fuel systems. And so if carbohydrate isn't present, or if we have to go without food for any period of time, then we have this other mechanism, this other system that then kicks in and enables us to carry on. You know, if we were just reliant entirely on carbohydrate, you know, we wouldn't be existing. You know, we would not have survived. And that's why we've evolved in that way, because we had to go for long periods without eating. So you've got to have another fuel on board. And, you know, what better fuel than what we've got it just distributed right across our body. For most of us, we've got really reasonable stores that can keep us going for quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And ketoacidosis is a unique scenario where essentially, I kind of use the analogy of you're sat in a boat and there's water everywhere. So you have glucose in your bloodstream, but you have no way of using that glucose and putting it into your cells because of the lack of insulin. And it's an issue where for that reason, your body goes into hyperketosis, where you're essentially pumping out loads of ketones. And that unfortunately leads to a change in your blood pH level, something that most medics at some point in their training will have come across and more than likely treated. But that's very different from the levels of ketones that you get in your blood when you're performing controlled. Nutritional
that's
ketosis.
Right. And I think probably the key thing that you mentioned there, the key difference is insulin. And so because nutritional ketosis is insulin mediated. I mean, there is insulin present. Insulin is not it's not abnormally low. It's not absent. And so it is actually being, it is there in the background and in control. And also the difference is that the glucose levels are within the normal range. So, you know, there are very well-defined differences that link it to a normal physiological process rather than an abnormal and a dangerous metabolic situation. So yeah, very, very different. And it's really, really important that people understand the difference.
Yeah,
and that, you know, ketones are present, as you said, in all of us. Mm-hmm. But when we are born, you know, we are operating on ketones.
Mm. I don't think a lot of people realize that.
And really, you know, the danger at that point, and colostrum that we secrete, you know, for the newborns is predominantly lipids and proteins. And that, again, potentiates the ketosis. And because the brain of a small human, it requires phenomenal amounts of energy. You know, we've got to keep it running. And there is often a gap between the way, you know, the milk coming in and being able to fuel that infant and that brain. So ketones are so valuable at that point. And then gradually we become less dependent, obviously, over time. And as we're fed, we become less dependent. But no, ketones are just part of us.
Yeah.
They're part of us. They're part of our fuel mix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by some of the work that you've done in cancer field as well. Again,
right.
Quite controversial area, not
yes.
that much evidence, but I'd
yes.
love to talk about the potential uses in cancer. From my understanding, we probably don't have enough evidence to say that it improves survival or longevity or, you know,
yeah.
Mortality rates with certain types of brain cancer. But there may be some benefits that we can at least establish in the short term using some of the studies that you've been involved in.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's been a lot of preclinical work done. Mm. And I think maybe specifically it's been within the brain tumor sector, because that's an area that we really have not managed to find. We've not got an improvement in outcomes really for a very, very long period of time, for decades. We're not really seeing massive improvements in survival. But I think it's very important to maybe consider that the brain tumor zone is a very big zone, and the high grade cancerous tumours are at one end, and that's where the predominant interest is, because that's the area where people tend to have very short prognosis, and this, you know, we desperately need to improve the outcomes. But there's a whole other area that's really relevant to ketogenesis and ketogenic diets within the brain tumour sector, and that's that you know, individuals with brain tumours readily have difficult to control seizures, and so this can be a really terrible sort of quality of life issue, and also fatigue as well. So the work that that we did, I obviously the Matthews Friends clinics were supported by the Astrew Brain Tumor Fund to actually support individuals with dietetic support for ketogenic therapy. Those individuals wanted to try ketogenic therapy, and then we supported them to do that. So they elected to do it, and they came to us for help. So we were were funded to help them. And what was really fascinating was really that quality of life aspect. If they had terrible fatigue, readily they got some benefits. If they were experiencing drug-resistant epilepsy and were having seizures that weren't brilliantly controlled, they readily got benefits. And so it's those elements, because those within the brain tumor community, it's known that those are difficult areas to tackle, because they are readily drug-resistant. There aren't necessarily strategies that easily manage those. But by changing the fueling in the brain, we do seem to be able to get some good effects. Yeah. So I think that's probably where I would say there's the most powerful, compelling reasons for trying to enable people, if they wish, to explore it. So for symptomatic individuals, I think there's great potential. I think there's a very big question over the high-grade tumour area. Again, I would say, from my experience of working with many, many individuals, the quality of life aspects seem to be very positive.
Yeah.
Now, what I would say is that these are individuals who are choosing already to, they want to do this, they're electing to do this. And for them, because they are enabled to make those choices, they tend to be very proactive individuals. They're not just doing ketogenic diet, they're often doing a whole mass of different things, and alongside standard of care, you know, they're not just doing diet, it's part of their whole gamut of things. They're trying to integrate everything, really. But they report doing well, feeling positive and feeling well. But what I would say is that, you know, this is not a quick fix for cancer. And I would say that if it was, fasting and using ketogenic diets, we would have learnt about that before now. You know, we realise, well, if people fast, wow, they produce a bit of ketones and they do really well. It's not as simple as that. But I do believe that there are some individuals that might do very, very well, but we don't really have a way of tracking it. And I think that's difficult. We don't really have ways of monitoring the impact that, you know, the whole mass of different changes that the individuals may be introducing into their lifestyle and to their diet, you know, whether they be using, different green tea, curcumin, they may be using some, you know, I don't know, probiotics. They might be going for hyperbaric oxygen treatment. They're using ketogenic diet. They're using chemo radiation, in the whole pathway. And we haven't got any idea. We don't really have any way of measuring
the impact, and that's the issue, tricky. I think. I think that's
really difficult.
The methodology by which we've traditionally done clinical trials is one intervention, one control, and looking at one outcome, or maybe like a couple of secondary outcomes or whatever.
Yeah.
But in reality, like the example you've just given, real life people are experimenting with hyperbaric oxygen, which is essentially when you go to your chamber and you reduce your atmospheric pressures, that might in combination with ketosis actually have some benefits.
There has been a published study of mice, with metastatic cancer, and that produced, and said, you know, it had an additive effect.
So
really I think we need to find some ways of tracking. And that's where when I was working with patients with brain cancer, again, you can get very hooked up on the numbers, like my ketones are here and my glucose is here. Is that right? It's not where I want it to be, and very number orientated. But the reality is we have no way of then connecting those numbers with what's going on in the tumour.
Exactly.
So, and that's where there's really, we don't have the ways currently, I don't believe, to evaluate and read, almost like read the metabolic signature. And we need to find ways of actually reading that and reading the impact, and almost like getting a readout to say, well, what we're doing is actually changing components we know are relevant, or doing what we're doing is not making a blind bit of difference. And that's what I'd really like us to be able to do. But we don't. So people may initiate changes, and as long as they're feeling really well, I mean, that's the other very important thing. If anybody changes the diet, not necessarily ketogenic diet, but changes the diet significantly, and they don't feel right, they don't feel well, it doesn't matter whether they think that's the best diet on this earth. It may not be the right thing for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's really, really important that people think carefully and also monitor how they're feeling.
Yeah.
And if they're not feeling right, they're not feeling well, they're not feeling happy with what they're doing, they absolutely have to change it.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's not right.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And it speaks to this whole idea of personalized medicine, which most people think of like, you know, high tech and greater sort of testing, but actually it's being intuitive as well.
You've got to combine that. And anybody who is using any dietary change to control any form of symptomatic issue, I think it's really important that people do start by thinking, right, where am I now, what am I doing right now, what would I like to change, what symptoms am I really targeting? And you do need to watch that. You need to really track yourself, almost like diarize what's happening, and navigate. You do need to navigate, but because the difficulty is you might just introduce something and think, well, maybe this is the right thing to do, but then further on down the line, you know, a few months, you're thinking, well, actually am I feeling any better? Am I not? But I'm really finding it difficult, but maybe I should stay with it, or, you know, and that's difficult then. So it's really important, I think, to think, well, what am I looking for? What do I hope for? What symptoms would actually make this justifiable, yeah, this change?
Yeah.
You know, what would I class as being a good outcome for me? What's my ideal outcome? What would be a reasonable outcome? And then work towards that. And if it's not working, change it.
Yeah. Well, this is why I really wanted to chat to someone like yourself about it, because not only are you up to date with the research and reading the journals and you have a general interest, but you're also a clinical dietitian. So you're getting those first person stories from patients and anecdotes, and you realize that, you know, just putting someone on a medical diet isn't the be on end all. And also, I think we have this, we tend to think of our bodies as very binary machines. You know, if we learn, for example, that cancers preferentially use the glycolytic pathway and chew up glucose, then ergo, we should go on a ketogenic diet that reduces the glucose in our serum, blood levels, reduces insulin, and therefore treats it as cancer itself, just as a particular condition, is evolving all the time. And it can adapt as well.
And it's different in everybody. Mm. And I think also just following on from that, it's very important to see that, you know, it's all very well making dietary changes, but, you know, is your gut functioning well? Is your liver functioning well? Is your, you know, is your kidneys functioning well? It's really, you know, for some individuals, it's not easy to change a diet, and it may not be appropriate at the time. And so it's really important, I think, to get good, you know, to get help, and to talk to your dietitian about diet, talk to them about if you've read something, ask them about it, speak to them about it, speak to your oncology team, because it may not be the right thing for you at all to do whatever change it is, but, you know, and it's important that you do navigate the right path for yourself.
Do you think clinicians and dietitians alike are becoming more receptive to the idea of different ways of treating illnesses, particularly oncology? Like, I know in America, there's definitely more talk of metabolic oncology as a field in itself,
right?
Where we look at, you know, how we can, yes, introduce dietary changes, but perhaps even tinker with a few other adjuncts to chemo and radiotherapy.
I think it's maybe a little bit slower. Well, you know, we're always slower than the US, aren't we? Unfortunately, I think it's a bit slower in the UK, and I think one of the difficulties, you know, when I encountered ketogenics, you know, I had to really rethink my views. I had to challenge my own view of what this was going to mean. You know, I perceived it was going to be, the diet was going to be inadequate in various vitamins and minerals, and it didn't have enough of this, didn't have enough of that. And, you know, I was shocked when I did analysis and thought, well, actually, this diet's really good. Yeah, it's one of the best profiles I've actually ever analysed. So, you know, you have to think twice about it. So there are many, you know, there are colleagues of mine, you know, working in various sectors of dietetics who may have not encountered, had to actually maybe look at this aspect.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it is difficult, because if you're not familiar with how things are put together and where the the alternative ways of finding your nutrients, and also, you know, one of the reasons that ketogenic diets are used by many people generally is in order to lose weight. One of the red flags within oncology is unexplained weight loss. So, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, if you are an individual who has got a cancer diagnosis and you go along to see your oncologist or even your dietitian and say, look, you know, I want to do a keto diet, they may just think, oh my God, you know, they're going to lose loads of weight, and they're going to really become very unwell. And if you do it and don't put in enough fats, you will lose loads of weight. You know, you may not feel very strong. You may not have the energy. So that caution is appropriate. But having said that, there are individuals who do go into this and do get on with it, and they do absolutely fine. So it always has to be, everything has always got to be individualised. You know, you can't really broadly say that any dietary approach, and that could mean any different dietary approach, is suitable for cancer patients or not suitable for cancer patients, yeah. because everybody's different. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got all sorts of different types of diagnoses. You've got different types of people, different age groups. So it's very, very important to take this down to that individual situation mm-hmm. and understand the needs of that individual. And it might be fine for them, but yeah. the next person, it may be totally inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad we touched on that because I think it's slightly a controversial area where we essentially sacrifice everything for maintaining weight. And for a lot of patients, and this is frustrations that have been relayed to me from cancer patients, that all my dietitian wants to talk to me about is maintaining my weight
yes.
by any means necessary. It means eating whipped cream, it means chips, it means anything. They just want me to maintain weight because the evidence shows if you maintain your weight, you have better clinical outcomes.
Yes.
Whereas with a keto diet, even if you're doing a keto diet well, you can still lose weight.
Yeah, initially, I would say initially some people and certainly those individuals that I've worked with who might be doing it for their brain tumour. I'm just trying to remember the numbers, but, you know, not, I think about 60 to 70%, maybe even 80% did lose some weight. Mm-hmm. Most of them were quite happy with that.
Yeah, and this is
the interesting thing, you see, because actually, if you think about, you know, we are a nation of, we tend to be more overweight than underweight. Mm-hmm. You know, there is that issue. Mm. And that's a bit of a conflict, really, because, you know, most of the time we're trying to get everybody to lose weight and then all of a sudden we've got a dietary approach that might help some people to lose weight effectively but we don't necessarily want to use it because it's ketogenic but no, I think it's and this is where I think it's the individuality situation. So and also we are fearful of including extra fats in our diet. You know, that's been ingrained in the population and in us, you know, as a dietitian. Again, I had to go through that sort of change in my approach and really just see things as macronutrients and we just need fuel. So if you're removing the carbohydrate fuel and you don't want to lose weight, you've got to add another fuel to the mix. And the absolute perfect fuel to add to the mix is more fat. You don't want to add more protein. We don't need more protein. We have ample protein. And certainly, you know, within this ketogenic world, we don't want excess protein either. So, but fat is perfect. That's exactly what we need. So it's difficult sometimes for some individuals because they think, right, I want to do ketogenics. But then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I've got to start adding fat to my meals. And I'm really worried because I think fat's going to cause my heart, you know, and all this conflict. And I think, so probably that's the reason why we have this issue now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people don't see them as evens. You know, this is just a different form of fuel. They see them loaded with this, that's bad.
Yeah.
Fat's bad. Carbohydrates are good. And, you know, nutritional science is much, much more complex than that.
Yeah, I think we need to start being less binary about it and actually appreciate that when someone is on that different a macronutrient mix, their internal environment is completely different and your body functions in a completely different way.
Yeah.
In an environment where your insulin is low and your glucose is stable and you're fueling your cells using ketone bodies, it's a completely different state of environment
climate.
Rather than like a high carb, high poor saturated fat diet as well.
Yeah, no, it's very, very different. And I think the key thing is that lowering the carbohydrate because, you know, the reduction of the carbohydrate does that underpinning, that massive background change. And the fat is just there as a fuel. You know, that's just your fuel. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And you need it there. Otherwise, you are going to, the body doesn't matter. You know, if it's in that, if it's been switched, it doesn't really care. It needs to use fuel. So if you put it in from the outside, it'll use it. That's fine. If you don't put enough in from the outside, it'll start using its bank and you'll lose weight. But, you know, in medical ketogenic therapy, this we can apply this to infants, we can apply it to children, we can still get them to grow. We do think that they don't maybe grow in height as well as they might on ketogenic diets, and that's why we don't often use, we may just use them for a couple of years. We don't keep them on them forever. And so, but we can, they can grow. They can grow perfectly well. And with adults, you can actually maintain weight. So often people might lose, initially might lose a kilo or so maybe kilo and a half, couple of kilos, and they all, their shape often changes. So often their waist shrinks.
Shrinks, yeah.
So their actual body shape might change, but their body weight might not change an awful lot. And it's perfect. You're perfectly able to maintain your weight, but you do have to then, you have to have enough fat fuel to keep your weight up.
This is a great segue into the adverse effects of ketogenic diet, because I feel like we've promoted the benefits of it.
No, absolutely. And we have to talk about the
potential downside, of which there are many different types of things that we need
absolutely.
To think about.
So one thing, and again, I just had a call before I came in to hear one of my patients had got a little, you know, this is a little child, has renal stones. And this is exaggerated, or the risk is exaggerated on ketogenic diets. And so it may well be that that individual already has a tendency, and it would be exaggerated in somebody with profound disability who maybe is not drinking that well, or is fluid limited, not mobile. You know, there are other risk factors. But yeah, renal stones are a downside. It doesn't affect everybody, but it is a risk. And so it's really important when we're using medical therapy, we would normally always check. We do full biochemical profiles before we treat the individual, and they're checked regularly every 3 to 6 months. And we would, in some children, you may even do renal scans. You know, you'll just do an ultrasound to check that the
regular.
You might do. Or if somebody has got they've had a risk in the past, or they've had a stone in the past, you might do regular scans. And there are certain drugs that might increase the risk as well within the epilepsy field. So those individuals, we'd be much more cautious. Renal stones, that's something that individuals get. And I have, I think, over 100 brain tumour patients, probably two develop renal stones as a result of their diet.
And the more common ones that you see, I'm assuming, are gut-related issues.
Yeah, and again, that's an interesting thing. About half may get a degree of constipation.
Okay.
It varies, but yes, generally, you can imagine why, because there is this massive change in the microbiota, and that probably drives this change within the bowel frequency. And constipation is probably the most common aspect. With occasionally individuals might get diarrhea, and again that may be associated with other elements. Maybe if you're introducing MCT and they're just building up tolerance, there may be more issues like diarrhea. Maybe get altered bowel habit, definitely. And we always try and preempt that. We always talk a lot about bowels. We never stop talking about bowels. As dietitians, we always talk about bowels. But you know, we're preempting it. So if you're starting with an individual that already has a tendency to constipation, then you absolutely try and make sure that they're already on something that's helping them to move. And then we would incorporate things like maybe flax into their diet, plenty of green vegetables, and just try and get as much fibre and fluids in as well. To try and just keep things going. So yeah, we always try and preempt that. I have had individuals who, and this is, again, I'm talking about adults, who have had massive improvements in their gut symptoms. I had two gentlemen who happened to be individuals who had brain tumours, who had massive transformations in they had severe reflux. And so when somebody has got severe reflux, you do think, I wonder whether this is going to be okay. Now, those two individuals, actually, it resolved completely.
Oh, wow.
And that's unusual.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think, that's just not right. Surely that's not right. But what I would suspect it was, it could well be that for those individuals, the introduction of the ketogenic diet actually excluded something from their diet that was causing them a problem.
Right, yeah.
So they... whatever it was, that improved. And that was a real shock, because you don't expect somebody to stop, having reflux. But for them, it was amazing. You know, they just had it for years. Yeah. And they just felt so much better, because they could sleep better, you know, they felt better. So, you know, it can affect the gut in different ways. You don't normally get things like issues like vomiting and problems like that. I mean, I think if that was occurring, we'd think there was something significantly wrong with the approach. Possibly if it had been driven in a bit too fast and there was alterations in, in the, if there's very high ketones, you'll get vomiting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but generally we don't generally get problems with vomiting. So it's more just the bowel.
With adults, particularly on the keto diet, do you see either an improvement or a worsening of their cardiovascular profile from a lipid perspective?
No, that's a very important area. And what I think, what we do see is, and this is part of the reason why we always do make, as part of the background biochemical profile, the lipid profile is very important to check. And I think there's a couple of different reasons why we think it's really important to check. One is because it's for the individual, for the patient. We want to see where they're starting out. But also, if you don't get a baseline and you just start picking up, you do it after the diet has been initiated, you may end up with sort of raised lipids, but they were always there in the first place.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think it is important to see where that individual, because we're all different. Mm. We start out differently. And what we tend to see in the early stages, you will get an increase in the LDL profile. Mm-hmm. So LDL, you will also get an increase in HDL.
Yeah.
And the triglycerides tend to be quite low.
Oh, low, right. Okay.
Yeah, low. Yeah, yeah. Because really triglyceride levels are more a reflection of carbohydrates than actually lipid or fat intake.
Yeah, yeah.
So triglycerides tend to be low and HDLs tend to rise, but the LDL rises too.
Yeah, you can understand why, I suppose, because LDL and HDL are essentially trafficking molecules for your fat.
That's right. And you know, you are changing the way that the fats are being transported around the system immensely. Mm. And so what we tend to see initially is you do get things ramping up, but then there have been papers published to suggest that by about 12 months, you tend to get things settling back down again. So there is an adaptation and a settling. But we never see that, you know, when you're trying to treat a difficult, complex condition such as drug-resistant epilepsy, it's very, very unlikely that the lipid changes in the lipids would actually stop the treatment, because you've got to really balance up where your benefits and your risks are, and the risks are not that high, and the benefits for some individuals are immense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, so we track because it's really important to track. Mm-hmm. And know what's happening, so that we've got a feeling of what's going on in the background. But if lipids do become higher, we are not totally alarmed, and we don't expect their lipids to fall into what you might class as standards. So we just track and monitor.
Yeah, these are very unique patients, and I guess again to the point about individualized medicine, it really does come down to, you know, which is worse. Is it the refractory epilepsy or is it the lipid profile that shows that there might be an increased risk? What I'm really interested in, and I haven't seen yet in papers, is low carbohydrate or even ketogenic diets over a long time period following a patient to see if they are at increased risk. I think definitely the lipoprotein profiles can give us an indication. And certainly LDL is related to the mechanism behind atherosclerosis, but I think we're still learning about whether, you know, on these particularly strict regimes where they have all the other things probably optimized as well, whether that actually leads to increased cardiovascular problems.
No, and I think we've also got to be aware that there are, you know, we've just talked about all the different pathways that are intervened, you know, and altered that don't really fit with the norm. Now, you could say that elements of those pathways may be disadvantageous, but also they may be tremendously advantageous. So when we're talking about the dialing down of various inflammatory pathways, you know, that's a very positive side effect. You know, and I think we just don't know enough yet. There have been some longer, I mean, there are occasional patients who've sort of, certainly the American teams, the occasional patient turns up, you know, like 20, 30 years, they're still on the same regime as they were as a child, and they're still here, you know, and they're still fine and they haven't got heart problems. But no, we haven't studied large numbers of people, you know, because I suppose it's really quite specialist.
Yeah, they're
you
very
know, there
impression.
Aren't, there aren't thousands
between,
that have been on it for long periods of time. Yeah. So I think that area, we've got to realise that it changes so many different aspects. And yes, I think it is important that people do monitor their lipids, but it's very, very important to look at that as a whole person's picture of where things have been dialed up and dialed down. And there was an interesting paper, you know, you've obviously got experience in general practice. There was an interesting paper published not that long ago that was looking at generally lower carb diets within general practice, mainly really targeting metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. And, you know, again, all the aspects, all the different parameters were looked at. And it was a very, very positive, you know, very positive in the outcome in the background. So I think we've got to look at the whole picture and not just home in on the lipids. You know, we've got to look at aspects like, you know, what about the blood pressure, you know, and what about the other risk factors? If that, I mean, most of our patients, they don't have metabolic syndrome. They're not diabetic, yeah. But I think when you're applying it to another sector, you've actually got to look at all the parameters and, you know, take a broad look at what's happening. And is it helping those individuals? And if it is, stick with it.
Certainly, I'm of the perspective that of this spectrum of low carbohydrate diets, where you have keto on one side and you have lower carbohydrate, moderate carbohydrate, Mediterranean along that spectrum continuum. There are probably benefits to be had for individual patients along that line. And I'm wondering whether there are ways in which we can appropriate which patients should be along that spectrum at some point in the future using
some parameters. Now, actually, you mentioning that, there was a recent paper that was actually really was really more talking about the muddling up of the description of ketogenic diet and low carb diets.
Okay, interesting.
And it was actually defining, trying to make a definition, because I think when, you know, if an individual chooses to do, that's not so much of an issue. But if it's talked about in academic and studies, in academic publications and studies, if somebody's talking about, well, this person was doing a ketogenic diet and this person was doing ketogenic, but they were doing completely different diets, things, you know. Somebody, in fact, was doing more of a lower carbohydrate diet. Yeah. The other one was doing ketogenic. You know, so you've got to have some sort of standards. And then there's also interest in low energy, you know, low calorie ketogenic diets as well. And that's, so you're bringing in also almost like that deficit of energy alongside the ketogenic aspect. So this paper, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but if, you know, I will make sure you have the details of it, because it's recently been published, and just saying, look, we need to be clear about the nomenclature here, because it's certainly, if we're going to be studying these things, we need to know what we're studying, and we need to be comparing apples with apples, not apples with pears. Otherwise, you're just going to get mixed data.
It's the same issue that's dogging the fasting world right now, because people talk about intermittent fasting, 5-2 alternate day, and water fasting in the same breath.
Yes.
And they you know, include that in all the intermittent fasting, but they're very, very different. The mechanisms can be similar, but they, you know, the way you dose this is very different as well.
And this is where, I mean, these two areas, they sit side by side, you know, fasting and ketogenic diet, you know, they're sharing the same sort of biochemical pathways, but there are differences. And I would say what's interesting about epilepsy is that we do find that for many individuals with epilepsy, fasting doesn't necessarily work brilliantly, because they need the fuel. Somehow they need that stabilization of fuel. So if they went without a meal or a snack, they may be very susceptible to seizures. And yet you'd think, well, no, but surely, you know, fasting.
Yeah.
But no, for many of them, but we do find the occasional individual who actually, their ketogenic effect and their control seems to be, they seem to feel a lot better if they do have episodes of fasting, but that's very rare for us.
Yeah,
that's, we really find that very unusual. Yeah. So for epilepsy, we tend to see that there seems to be more benefit from regular fueling, but in the right
proportions,
that sort of higher fat, low carb mix, but keeping that brain fueled steadily rather than leaving it for long periods without fuel.
I think, you know, it's so interesting, because there's so many other parameters that we would probably need to determine as to which patient would benefit from fasting, what, like what their fat stores are at the moment.
That's also really crucial, because some people, you know, have got a low BMI.
Yeah.
It may be much harder for them to maintain stable ketones and stable levels. So really there is a risk actually treating people who have got very low BMI because they may just be more brittle. So you're probably better off with somebody who has got, you know, they're sort of 18 and above as a BMI. You don't really want somebody who's just really, I mean, we can do it. We can do it. We can get an effect. But it's probably harder to maintain a stable effect.
Yeah, and I think there's probably some difference in the types of fats as well. I've heard polyunsaturated fatty acids have a better impact on the excitatory potential of your neurons as well. So that's super interesting. I wanted to, we could whittle on the whole time. I wanted to talk to you specifically about the myths that you want to try and dispel around ketogenic diets, because I think in the public sphere as well as in the medical sphere there is a lot of fear around this topic, and I think that's why I really wanted you to come on today to talk about it more openly, honestly, and talk about the research. But what are the things that actually gripe you the most when it comes to
I think probably the main thing is this concept of that a ketogenic diet will always, I mean, I think we've touched on it, will always make you lose weight. And the reality is that that's not so. If you consume sufficient fuel, you can stabilize that weight. And so it's just a case of actually getting that fuel mix right and eating enough fat. So it's really just getting that mix. But yeah, you can find it easier to lose weight, but you don't have to lose weight. As long as you're eating enough fat.
As long as you're eating enough fat.
And that's, and because, you know, people are fearful of eating fat, that can be tricky for some people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, we're not used to it. You know, when you have those rolls, you weren't immediately going to put butter on them. But that's, you know, you do need to keep adding that real fat. You know, fats, oils, things need to be shiny and glossy.
Glossy.
Otherwise, it's not right. It's not right.
Brilliant.
So that's probably the main thing. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the main thing. And I think also, for the majority of individuals, we don't have a metabolic dysfunction. The majority of adults, you know, once, if we've got to adulthood, we would probably be aware if we fasted or if we became unwell and we were unwell for a couple of days and didn't manage to eat, we would know if we responded really badly to that and became unconscious or just unable to function. And that would indicate that you just didn't have that adaptability and you couldn't really upregulate your fat metabolism and cope with fasting. Individuals like that, or individuals with abnormalities of fatty acid metabolism, cannot do ketogenics. You know, you've got to have an appropriately functioning, appropriately functioning fat metabolic system. So I think that the trick would be, you know, if when you don't eat, you become really, really unwell, then that it may well be that it's not the right thing for you. When we use it for epilepsy, we check the background biochemistry. You know, we check for urine organic acids. We look at the carnitine status, because carnitine is important for shuttling the fats into the cells for beta oxidation and processing. So it's really, you know, we have to have a functioning system. So it is important, but the reality is that most of us actually, we're okay. You know, we can cope with without having carbohydrate. You know, it's not, you know, and this is really, really controversial. We can survive without carbohydrate because we can create it ourselves. Now, it's not, it doesn't mean to say we've got to survive without it. You know, we can consume it and most of us can cope with it perfectly well. But for some people, they actually function better with less carbohydrate and more fat.
I think we need to be more
fuel mix.
To be more open-minded to that. Because I think when people initially hear, oh, you don't eat carbohydrates, it's almost like people suggest that that's a blanket statement, whereas actually no, it's down to the individual. And you know, we talk about epilepsy and cancer patients and a whole bunch of other applications, but it really does come down to the individual. And on that note, I was going to ask you, if you had your crystal ball and you're looking at the future applications of ketogenic diets, where do you think the next sort of realm of medicine is going to benefit from?
Well, I think that you know, the way that we do things by diet means that we have to evolve the effect, right? So we have to get that adaption for the body then to get those ketones produced, which doesn't take too long. But if you're dealing with a really critical situation, so if you're dealing with really a significant brain injury, you're dealing with status epilepticus, say, you know, the brain is in a catastrophic state, then it may well be that we need to we need to start using some compounds that can actually deliver ketones straight into the system, so that we can actually deal with that acute issue, and almost like rescue the brain, because a lot of brain damage leads to this a period of hypometabolism. So the cells are struggling because they just can't get fueled properly. And then damage arises as a result of that. So, you know, it's almost as if you can pop in another fuel as a, right, well, let's chuck this in the mix so that the brain can keep functioning okay while everything else is being sorted out. That would be great. Now, we do have things called ketone esters that are coming around now, but they haven't yet been fully clinically evaluated. Mm-hmm. And they really are being used more, you might say, in the lifestyle side of things at the moment. But, you know, they have immense potential for clinical application, but we haven't explored it adequately at all. Mm. So, but I would say that we do need to find ways to ideally replicate the ketogenic effect in an easier way.
Yeah.
I'd love it. If we could do it,
yeah,
I'd give in tomorrow. I'd be off. But at the moment, we can't. You know, we can only do it this way. We can only get the effects we get by doing it longhand.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would love it if we could do it shorthand. Yeah. But, you know, it could well be that we can find ways for some people. They just include some MCT, a lower carb diet, put some MCT in. Or there are some fat components being evolved that might just help with that.
Yeah. I've heard of actually some
C10.
Yeah,
there's some C10 supplements being evaluated at the moment, and they may provide an interesting potential. Mm. But, you know, I think we've got to find other ways. We've got to accept that fueling is absolutely crucial. We've got to optimize fueling in the body.
Mm.
And if body or the cells are damaged in such a way that they are not fueled optimally, they're not going to function.
Yeah, yeah.
And this could be underpinning a lot of neurological conditions.
Yeah.
So it's not the answer, but it may be part of the answer.
Yeah.
It's using it as a component of the therapy to deliver an element, maybe so that other areas can be, you know, improved.
Yeah, I'm watching this space with fascination and awe.
It's really exciting. We've got a long way to go.
Definitely, absolutely.
A long way to go.
Yeah, and if people wanted to find out a bit more, you know, listen to this podcast, then you, someone with refractory epilepsy or cancers, where do you think the best sort of resources are out there?
Well, in terms of, you know, general information about sort of the general sort of consumer information about lowering carbohydrate and having more fats, I would say that dietdoctor.com is a really good starting point. It has a lot of information on there. It's really nicely produced, nice and bright and graphical. Yeah. You know, it's nice and clean and clear. Yeah. It's got a lot of good information. Obviously, the Matthews Friends website has got some background information, but we were very mainly focused on the medical ketogenic therapies, which is, of course, really about the epilepsy side of things. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of information, there's ideas, and there is also access information to access lists of centers that are providing the therapy, you know, for clinical therapy. So within epilepsy, you know, you can be referred to a specialist center. There are adult centers, there are pediatric centers. When we're talking about any other application, there's very little.
Yeah.
Sadly, there's very little.
Yeah.
And so what I would like to do is enable those individuals who want to look down and want to look at specific things, they can look at them.
Yeah.
But we don't bring it as a, you know, because there's a lot of people just listen. But if they want to really know more about certain things, then we can probably put key papers that are really informative and sensible.
We'll definitely link to those in the show notes.
Yeah.
And like I said, I really do appreciate you coming down. It's been an absolute pleasure to listen to you again for the second time.
Yeah.
And do stay in contact, because I'd love to, you know, talk about this again and perhaps at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe even get some sort of like patient anecdotes or something, because I think the work that you're doing is underrepresented, and I think it's underappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the more open conversations we have about the benefits of different dietary regimes, the better it is for everyone. And so this is one of my gripes within clinicians and patients as well, is
it's easy to dismiss things without really looking to it and just saying everything's nonsense, whereas actually you need to dig a little bit deeper and look at you know, how this impacts individuals. And if people are saying, I feel great on this, then it warrants more attention. So thank you so much for your work.
No, that's great. No, thank you for inviting me, because of course it enables me to talk about my favourite subject.
Yeah, and have some food.
And have some food, which is even better. Yeah, being cooked for, that's great. Yeah. So thanks ever so much. Thank you.
No worries.
I really hope you enjoyed that podcast with Sue. She is absolutely brilliant. I should say that she continues to oversee the treatment of adults and children with drug-resistant epilepsy and mentors NHS teams who are keen to explore ketogenic diets in clinical scenarios in adults with, for example, status epilepticus. So you can definitely find out more from her directly. I've put her contact details on the show notes, plus all the references to the studies that we discussed today, as well as some extra reading materials for you. She recommends a book that gives you a real deep dive into the history of keto, as well as the potential uses of keto. It's a book by Mary T. Newport, who's a doctor whose husband sadly passed away from Alzheimer's, but she used a low carbohydrate diet in treatment of that, and actually did a lot of research in that too. Just to summarize, you know, we talked about what a keto diet is, the history of keto, the uses beyond epilepsy, and I think the show notes in this particular episode are going to be really useful to give you a little bit more context to what we were talking about today. As always, please do give this a 5-star review, sign up to the newsletter. We'll post the recipes on YouTube, and we give you science-based recipes every single week when you sign up to the Doctor's Kitchen, thedoctorskitchen.com. You can check out the newsletter there. Have a wonderful day, and I will catch you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.